broadcasting from Melbourne, Victoria. You're listening to the Investor Exchange. Tune in each week and listen to the guys from United Global Capital discuss the topics that matter the most to your finances. Each episode will help you separate the noise from what really matters, giving you timely and actionable information you can use. We'll cover areas related to financial markets, property, politics, personal finance, and the economy. Now, here's your host, Stephanie Sumner.
Good morning, listeners. Welcome to this week's episode of the Investor Exchange. I'm your host today, Louis van Copenhagen, and joining me in the studio is Brett Dickinson.
I'm back.
And Joel Hewish.
Good morning. How are we, guys?
Fantastic, thanks.
Another week.
Very good, yep. Very good.
Yep. And what's today, Joel?
International Women's Day.
Oh, well.
All right.
Happy International Women's Day to all of our cherished female friends.
So in the spirit of that, we've given Steph the day off.
Exactly.
Take it easy, Steph.
No, Steph is actually filming some events for International Women's Day today, so it's an early start for her, and she couldn't make it this morning.
A busy day for her.
Yeah.
Absolutely, a lot to cover, and we just want to pay tribute to all the women in our lives, special people, our wives, partners, mothers, sisters, daughters. Really, from the bottom of our hearts, we love you.
Yes.
Of course we do.
Yes, indeed.
Absolutely.
Great way to start the day.
Oh, and to our staff members here too.
And our staff members, of course.
Yes.
Yep.
We're about a 50-50, I think, organisation. 50% female, 50% male, roughly.
I think that'd be fair comment. In fact, I think there's probably more females than males.
Well, it's a big day for them then.
Yeah.
That's right. Excellent. Well, thank you. We have a big data-driven day today. So lots of... is it specific news or is it just where you guys have had your eyes lately?
I just happened to see, I guess because it's early in the month, a lot of the data that comes through from the preceding month tends to come out at the same time, and I just saw a snapshot of a few that I thought was relevant to discuss.
Okay.
Yeah. I think that, yeah, it's just a flow of data, that important data, I think, just to touch base on. Take a bit of a health check and see what that means for investment in the real estate market and the stock market.
Yeah, absolutely.
I guess it's always good to have an eye on the scoreboard.
Yeah, exactly. That's right. And at the end of the day, data is what our investment lives are based on, isn't it?
Correct.
Yeah. If we didn't have the data, if we were just trying to invest by gut feel or without rules, it'd be a free-for-all.
Yeah.
And you wouldn't have... much success.
Yeah.
You'd be throwing at a dartboard.
Yep.
That's right.
Yep. All right. Well, look, let's kick it off with the share market or property market.
Well, I'll tell you what, we're not actually even looking at the share market at the moment.
Oh, okay.
It's more around the general conditions of the economy.
Right.
Okay. Well, Joel, why don't you give us the conditions of the economy, and then
yeah,
Brett,
sounds
I presume
like
you're
both markets.
That's right. And then Brett, you'll hone it in on property specific.
Property
stuff. Yep. So, Joel, what
Good
have
plan.
You got?
Well, there's certainly been a trend towards slowing and moderation in economic growth, both here in Australia and also over in the United States as well, which, you know, in some regards, is a little bit. When you look at what happened just before Christmas time, where the US Federal Reserve was so hawkish and aggressive with their commentary around interest rates, and why they've had to reverse so suddenly from that position, you sort of wonder what was going on. It was only about 8-9 weeks ago, 10 weeks ago, that the Fed was talking about raising interest rates, you know, two times. And
effectively and betting that the US economy was so strong they'd have to put brakes on.
And then to be forced to reverse that position so quickly, you sort of wonder, what were they looking at? What,
yes.
I mean, this is the most powerful, you know, most influential central bank in the world, and really they ballsed it up. They ballsed it up in no uncertain terms.
Yep. So they're contradicting themselves in a quick time frame.
Yeah, that's exactly right. So
well, a central bank should not be so sensitive to month-to-month changes.
Correct.
They should be seeing the longer-term big picture.
You would think so. You would think so.
You would.
But they didn't. look, we have seen that moderation in economic growth, both in Australia and also over in the United States. So US GDP growth for the fourth quarter grew at just 2.6%, which was down from the brisk 3.4% at the end of the third quarter last year and down from around about 4.1% the quarter before. So no doubt you're seeing some moderation in US economic growth, and that's largely probably the result now of some of those interest rate increases that were being pushed through. Remember, there was 4 interest rate increases in the US in 2018, and the US has been increasing interest rates from 0.5% all the way up, well, actually from, what was it, 0.5% or 0.25%?
That's right.
All the way up to now, I think it sits at around about 2.5%. So, you know, you've seen a very substantial increase in percentage terms in regards to the cost of funding in the US. And that's now starting to have an impact on their construction sector. So housing was booming between the periods of 2013 through to 2017. That's now moderating in the US, and obviously, you know, the high cost of funding is now having an impact on new infrastructure jobs and construction jobs in the housing sector. So we are starting to see a moderation in economic growth in the US, but we are also seeing a moderation in economic growth in Australia, which is probably a combination of a few different factors. One, that employment wages increasing at a fairly modest pace for an extended period of time. We've seen, you know, households take on quite a significant amount of debt in the last several years as property prices have been increasing and people...
And interest rates are low.
And interest rates are low, And we're now starting to obviously see some softening in house prices, probably a correction in house prices, no doubt. So that's now starting to impact on consumer behaviour. Which is flowing into retail sales, where the retail sales data this week was pretty soft as well, barely growing in the final quarter of last year. In actual fact, and the news wires have jumped all over this. If you look at Australia's gross domestic product on a per capita basis, which is on a individual person basis, the Australian economy actually had a technical recession. Now, it's not called a recession in the true sense of the word, where you see...
GDP fall.
Yeah, that's right. Real GDP fall for 2 consecutive quarters. In fact, the last 2 quarters of GDP have still been positive in Australia. But on a per-person basis, GDP did fall. So without population growth, where we would have perhaps slipped into a recession over the last 2 quarters of last year. So where to from here? What does this mean? Well, you know, the central banks do have some maneuvers that they can make, and they have some levers that they can pull. And one of the things that's been going on as well, while real estate prices have been softening, is that banks have actually sort of been forced to raise their interest rates out of the RBA rate cycle, because the cost of funding, particularly over in the world's most largest, most deepest, most liquid capital market, the US, have been increasing. And because the banks get a significant proportion of their funding from overseas, even though interest rates from the Reserve Bank have not been forced to increase, funding costs for the banks have still been increasing, even though we've seen a softening in the Australian economy. So what happens? What's the likely solution?
Well, is that relationship potentially broken between the RBA and what the banks are going to do with interest rates?
It's not broken, but the banks only get between 1/4 and 1/3 of their funding from the Reserve Bank interest rates. So when the Reserve Bank raises or reduces their rates by 0.25%, it actually only affects the bank's margin across 1/4 or 1/3 of their total loan book.
So with most of the commentary saying that the next rate movement in Australia is likely to be down,
I think it's almost certain to be down. I wouldn't be surprised that we see a rate cut in the next month or two, to be honest with you. Things are certainly softening, and I think it justifies a relatively preemptive, or maybe it's not even preemptive really, but I think there is an adjustment that is perhaps needed. Just to provide some cushioning to households. You know, you've seen probably close to about 0.5% increase over the last 12 months in the average cost of a mortgage, as well as the, you know, the investment loan interest rates have also risen a lot faster than the mortgage rates. So I think there's an argument to suggest that, you know, an interest rate cut sometime in the next few months is not to be unexpected.
What is surprising is that the Reserve Bank has two options for affecting people's behaviour. One is actually reducing rates, and the other is talking about reducing rates.
Yes.
That in itself has an impact on people's sentiment. And it's strange that they haven't yet come out and started talking about reducing interest rates. It's only been a few fringe economists that have been talking about rate cuts.
We need that commentator you mentioned late last year in the US that could say a few words and the market turned instantly.
Oh,
that was power.
Yeah, that's who? Jerome Powell?
That was it.
Yeah. Jerome Powell, the central bank governor.
Central bank.
In the US. Yep. Yeah, so you're absolutely right, Louis. And I think we're going to see that the commentary around cutting interest rates maybe by 0.25%, you know, some economists are expecting interest rates might get down to 1%. There is an argument to suggest that you probably wouldn't want to go too far below 1%, because some suggest that, you know, below 1%, you actually do more damage than good with not actually having much of an interest rate.
Right.
You know, the arguments there can be debated. But, you know, I think that there is a case for offsetting some of that higher funding costs and some of those higher borrowing costs, particularly with the given state of the economy at the moment. Now, does that mean doom and gloom? I mean, are we sitting on the precipice of a recession here in Australia? I don't think technically we're going to fall into one, but yeah, you know what, we could stall for a couple of quarters, you know, on a you know, real GDP basis. What does that mean for the stock market? To be honest with you, the stock market tends to be more influenced by what happens over in the US. The Australian stock market tends to be more influenced by what happens in the US and around corporate profitability in the US and the US's you know, GDP prospects. And while that's moderating, I think it's highly unlikely that the US is going to fall into a recession this year. So, you know, all things being equal, I think what you need to do is understand that you've got to really be a stock picker in this market. You can't afford just to buy the top 50 blue chip companies that are going to have broad exposure to the performance of the Australian economy. That just won't deliver returns for you. You need to be really picking the eyes out of those stocks that are growing their revenues and profits and their profit margins independently of what the economy is doing. Focus on those types of businesses that have less economic sensitivity. So, you know, think about businesses like we always keep talking about, you know, strong recurring revenue streams they're critical to the way that humans or businesses function. So software vendors, healthcare providers, pharmaceuticals, these types of businesses.
And Joel, I think people who haven't been choosing their stocks with that level of research and consideration, they should probably have learned a lesson from the last 2 years, because the ASX 200 has been moving in this sort of 5,500 to 6,200 range for the last, what, two and a half years?
Well, to be honest with you, the Aussie stock market has really done almost nothing since 2015.
Yeah.
If you go back to, you know, January, February, March of 2015, you're looking at the Aussie at around about 6,000, the ASX 200 at about 6,000, and today it's only sitting at about 6,250.
Yep.
So if you were an investor for the last 4 years, and you were just investing in the biggest companies on the stock market that are the most tied into the performance of the Australian economy, all you would have done is receive dividends, and that's about it.
So you've treaded water.
Yeah. And that's, I guess, why a lot of super funds are sitting on this sort of 6-7% just on dividend earnings and not actually getting any growth in their portfolio.
Correct.
Yeah. Whereas what's some results from your portfolio?
Over that same period of time, we're sort of tracking around the 13 to 15% net of all fees during that period of time. So, it's been a significant difference. Mm,
yep.
That's right.
So, it just shows the value of doing that picking and choosing the right stocks.
That's right.
So, where to now?
Well, where to now? I don't think that, once again, I mean, I don't see this as the start of a major bear market. The conditions that typically lead to, you know, major bear markets are not prevalent. But what we are seeing is that, you know, moderation is seriously underway. And in that environment, it is going to be harder to see stock prices rise substantially from their current levels until we start to see some signs of a turnaround or an improvement. But that doesn't mean that share markets are going to just fall off a cliff either. In fact, I think the perhaps the most reasonable assumption might be that you would be expecting sort of range trading for a period of time until we start to get some clarity that perhaps this slowdown has found a bit of a trough and we're starting to sort of find some stabilization there.
Yeah. And Joel, in recent episodes, you mentioned there's been a lot of volatility, and I think probably a month to 6 weeks ago, there seemed to be quite a significant downturn, and then recently it's been an upturn. What's the overall scenario on that? Has it recovered all of the downturn that first came about?
Well, it depends on what market you're looking at. But if we just focused on the Australian stock market, as of last night, we've almost got back to where we were before this correction started in the middle of last year. So prior to around July of last year, the ASX was sitting at around about 6,350. Today it's sitting at 6,250. It is probably at risk of a bit of a correction here. In fact, futures are pointing down to start the morning today off the back of some weak trading in the US last night or over the night. So, the US is already probably starting its correction. It's probably off around about 1.5% over the last week and a half. We could see a 5% correction, maybe even a 10% correction from current levels and still be looking relatively good for the rest of this year. You don't see stock markets rise by 20% off their lows without some sort of, selling that comes in and profit taking that comes in from that. And I think that that's fair and reasonable to assume that that's where we are right now, that we're probably going to be looking at a period of correction. But I think that we'd be buyers on this correction. I don't think we'd be concerned that this is going to turn into a major recession. And that's what we're expecting to do. We've got our buy list ready, and we're looking to perhaps nibble away at a few of these wish list stocks that we're wanting to try and get into over the next several weeks.
Correct me if I'm wrong, but recently you've been saying that corporate profits have been very healthy. So I guess this is concern around the potential for future profits.
Correct. Yep.
Which is mostly going to impact those cyclical type of stocks. So again, comes back to what you're saying about being very careful in the exact shares that you're buying.
Correct.
So I wouldn't be surprised if we see the Australian market down because it is so heavy into our retail banks and our mining companies.
Definitely.
And an economy like the US, either middling or even trending a little bit up. But again, you're going to see some significant losers if some companies' corporate profits decline, but other companies are going to streak ahead, aren't they?
You've got to focus on growth, right? Growth is very forgiving. And focus on those businesses that have a growth model that is, independent of what the economy does. And while you might still see volatility in those share prices as the general market sells off, what you'll find is that once we find some stabilization, those are the ones that tend to rocket like a slingshot out of those corrections.
Very interesting. Yeah. All right.
What about you, Brett? What are you seeing as a result of some of this slowness? What are you seeing in the property market? Is there some stats that are correlating with what we're seeing here?
Yeah, pretty well linked, I would say, just based on what you've said there. I mean, we've spoken recently that the property market's in a slight decline, and that looks like it's continuing. It's not a rapid decline, it's just a softening. And I've got some data that I'd like to sort of go through. Maybe we'll take a quick break and we'll come back and I'll go through that.
Yeah, let's take a quick break. Listeners, we'll be back shortly.
Want to learn the strategies that have achieved returns more than double the return of the average superannuation fund? Each day, clients of United Global Capital are using strategies and tactics that were once thought the domain of the professional investor or the super rich. Book your seat at UGC's Financial Fast Track Seminars, where you'll learn the science behind selecting high-performance stocks and real estate, how you can participate in advanced strategies like property development, short selling, and international investments, as well as how to protect your wealth against major adverse market events. To secure your seat, simply go to ugc.net.au/events and select the seminar that suits your needs. Seats are limited, so book your spot now.
And welcome back. Thank you, listeners. Over to you, Brett.
Sure. So, yeah, at the start of the month, well, at the end of February, a lot of the research we look at for property comes out, giving us the data for the month. And as Louis, you mentioned before, there's the data that we look at, and then there's the market commentary that sort of comes into play with how people make decisions. So a lot of the commentary is from the different people, different media around property and people giving their, I guess, opinion on what the data really means and what the future is likely to hold. And most of the commentary is that the majority of the Australian property market will be slow for the majority of 2019.
Yeah.
And there seems to be a consensus amongst that commentary that property will start to grow again in 2019. Mm-hmm. So if that were the case and I was considering buying, well, that means that I'm going to want to be looking at buying in the next year to start to be in a position to benefit from that upswing.
Yep.
But anyway, what the data is saying. So I've got a couple of major sources. So SQM Research and CoreLogic are two of the biggest. And what they've said at the end of February is that residential listings across the country actually increased by 4.6% for the month of February.
Right.
Now, that's not unexpected because January is typically a slow month. So you always expect February to have more houses appear on the market as people come back to from holidays and into their yearly routine. So I think it's more of an indicator if we look at it compared to last year. And from last year, listings for February 2019 are actually up across the country around 8% from February 2018.
Right. Wow.
So that's a sign that there's a lot of vendors are confident that the market's good enough to be selling in for them to realize what they want.
Mm.
So that's a nice strong indicator. And look, just to for a lot of this data, I might just focus on the three major capitals, Sydney, Melbourne and Brisbane. I mean, there is data for the rest of them, but they're the biggest markets and where a lot of the data is driven from.
Yep.
So the yearly change in Sydney is 14.4%.
In terms of increases.
In listings. Yep. Melbourne, I was quite shocked at this, 30.8%.
Increase, right?
From February last year. Now, obviously, they're only looking at what it was in February and what it was in February this year. So in between those months, there's probably a lot of differences. But just purely looking at it from where we were last year to where we were today. And then Brisbane, an increase of 8.8%. So to have more people wanting to sell now than they were this time last year shows that there's enough confidence in the market that the buyers are there.
Potentially, or there could be
or they could be desperate for some.
There could be some forced selling in there as well.
Forced selling, but we're not seeing reasons for the forced selling to be happening.
No, you're absolutely right, and we touched on this a couple of weeks ago that mortgage stress and mortgage delinquencies are generally in line with. Historical averages. So we're not seeing that financial stress that's leading to forced selling broadly in the Australian property market, but there's certainly pockets of areas that perhaps, you know, you're starting to see a little bit of that. Maybe Western Sydney seems to be the red zone or the red spot.
Yeah. Yep. The mortgage belt, as they say.
Yep. Yep. And probably that it takes a bit of time for an overheated pocket to then translate into a distressed selling pocket.
Yeah.
And that was unlikely to be last year because that was only the recent downside from the market really heating up.
Yeah.
So someone who bought in 2018, come 2019, yeah, maybe they're in enough financial distress to sell, but definitely the ones who bought in 2017, who are sort of 18 months into the mortgage repayments that they can't actually afford, they're going to be the distressed sellers.
Yeah. And coming back to some of the commentary, so the commentary that I've been hearing and the majority of people obviously saying, you know, continued declines in 2019, but they're indicating that a peak to trough decline, so from where we were at the peak to where they see it bottoming out, no more than 20%. And they're really only seeing that possibly happening in Sydney.
Okay.
So they're imagining the rest of the country and Melbourne being the next biggest market from Sydney, you know, declines from peak to trough of 10 to 15%. Okay, and at the moment, we're probably sitting on around 8 to 12% in those two. So there may be some further declines throughout the year. That doesn't mean there won't be good properties to buy and worthwhile opportunities, but it does mean that the overall market as an average is expected to continue to decline a little bit, especially when the lending landscape's a little bit uncertain and there's a few other variables impacting it.
Yep.
The other factor that I thought was always keen to give us an indication is the clearance rate.
Right.
Okay.
How's that looking now?
Well, it's interesting because, unfortunately, it's an imperfect science because there's multiple, well, you've got the two main media houses in domain and realestate.com that release a clearance rate, and they're never the same.
Right.
So they're never, you know, they have different volumes of auctions and therefore they have different clearance rates according to where they're getting their information. But if you look at the two of them, you know, in comparison, yeah, well, even if you just compare the two of them, they're always within a couple of percent. Yep. So we know it's around this. So, yep. You know, to give you an indication, so realestate.com said for the week ending Wednesday the 6th of March, Victoria's auction clearance rate was 59%.
Okay, do we know what the historical average is generally for auction clearance rates? It's around about 65 or something.
Yeah, 65. Yeah, that's two-thirds is sort of neutral.
Yeah. Okay. Yeah, so they call a balanced market at around the low 60. 60 to 65% is where they see a balanced market. Yep. Okay. And of course, a clearance rate is considered to be the leading indicator as to the strength of the market in terms of supply and demand.
At some points towards last year, I think the clearance rate was getting down about a third, wasn't it?
It depends on which market you look at, and again, which data source.
Yeah, yeah.
Unfortunately, because auctions aren't necessarily prevalent in all states, that's where it's a bit hard to use it as a national measure. Mm. Melbourne's definitely the auction capital. We have probably 20 to 30% more auctions than Sydney, which is next, and then again higher than the others. Whereas in some states, you know, Western Australia, South Australia, and Tasmania, auctions are very rarely held, or a small percentage of sales are done via auction. But to go through what the auctions clearance rate's been for the last week, so Sydney was at 65% according to Domain, and 70% according to realestate.com.
Okay.
Queensland 35% and 25%, so obviously a lot lower, but that's pretty typical for Brisbane based on what I've seen, because a lot of buyers just aren't used to auctions there. No. So I always think the clearance rate in Brisbane's significantly lower than the other two, and I don't see that as a really sound indicator of the market.
Okay.
Purely because the volume's not there. Like that 78 auctions in Brisbane versus close to 1,000 in Melbourne.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Big difference.
Yeah. Yep. So it's hard to really trust that data. And then look, there is some data for Adelaide, 37%. Canberra 38%, but again, very small volumes, like under 100 transactions in each market. So with Victoria being the biggest one, there's also one other media house that does give us a clearance rate, which is the REIV, and they claim that there was 888 auctions and a clearance rate of 57%.
Okay.
So based on that, it means it's a buyer's market in Melbourne at the moment, but it's close to a balanced market.
Mm. Okay.
So that's an interesting stat. And look, a couple more. What the median price buys you around Australia. I thought this was an interesting thing. So current median price, and again, I'll stick with the big three. So median house price in Sydney at the moment's $950,000. But what does that mean? What can you buy for $950,000 in Sydney? So an indication here as to what's on the market. A one-bedroom, one-bathroom attached terrace in an inner-city suburb on just 57 square metres of land sold in November last year for
$950,000. Wow.
Okay. So we know the market's declined a little bit since then. And who knows, that might have had something really unique about it. So
gold.
This is a very...
gold in the ground.
It might have had some significant views, or it might have just, you know, had some really nice fittings and fixtures.
That's not even the size of a balcony, really.
Yeah, 57 square metres.
That's right. It's a moderately sized one-bedroom apartment.
Yeah.
Okay, and so in comparison to that, if you head 60 kilometres from the CBD in a suburb called Harrington Park, a five-bedroom, two-bathroom, double garage house with a pool on 700 square metres of land, sold in December for $960,000.
And where was that, sorry?
Harrington Park, 60 kilometres from the CBD.
Right, okay.
Okay, so that's, you know, an indication of that's the median, but very different dwellings. And then sort of in the middle there, a terrace in Surry Hills sold for $950,000.
Right.
So you sort of got, you know, your small dwelling, your bigger dwelling, and your average dwelling.
Correct.
But obviously, it's location dependent.
Yeah.
But that's indicative of what you could get for the median in Sydney. Mm. If you look in Melbourne, median at around 840. So there's a terrace in Richmond that's on the market now for 840. But interestingly, dwellings in the outer suburbs are significantly cheaper than the median,
right,
where obviously the, you know, the green belt where they release a yep. lot of the new house and land packages. So the median on a 4-bedroom, 2-bathroom, double garage house on over 400 square metres in Point Cook, which is only 25 kilometres, is only at 680.
Right.
So significantly below the median.
Yeah.
And if you head out to Tarneit for a comparable property, it's 560,000. So
I don't know about you guys. I've just talking to clients and talking to others that, you know, are in our industry, there seems to be a general feeling of like, it's too hard to get finance, so I'm not even going to bother to get finance. Or there seems to be like this, you know, the property market's weak, so I'm just not going to do anything at this point in time. It's almost like there's just like an inertia at the moment, or a, you know, lack of excitement, and not fear and pessimism, but just a lack of excitement seems to be around.
Yep. A bit of a nonchalance.
So what is it going to take to turn that around? Well, you know, maybe we just need to see some stabilization. We need to see some headlines that are showing that maybe some of this softness in the economy, in the real estate market, you know, is starting to level off.
Well, I would actually take a different point of view and say, well, if you're interested in investing in property or you want to buy your family home, now's a great time.
Yeah. Yeah.
Now would be an ideal time to be getting your stuff together,
yeah,
because the lenders out there will lend. The process is taking longer because of all of the complications around,
yep,
you know, the Royal Commission and how they've had to change it, but they're still lending.
Absolutely.
And all the brokers we're talking to are still getting that finance approved.
Yep.
So
the fact that that middle portion of the market is not excited is exactly why the market is softer.
Correct.
Yeah.
When that middle part of the market turns and becomes excited, that's what drives the market up.
Mm.
But if you're in the middle, you're only going to catch the market when it's already had its up, or is, it might still be traveling up. If you want to be ahead of the market, then now's the time. That
correct,
old saying in the share market is to
be greedy.
Be greedy when others are fearful, be fearful when others are greedy. But if you have certain rules about what you're buying, and you're buying a quality investment in the right location with the right attributes, as long as you're buying quality, you're going to have a floor under your price, and you'll be positioned to catch the majority when they turn.
Mm.
It was not your smart investors who were buying at the end of the boom times.
No.
Mm.
It is your smart investors who had already bought, already positioned their portfolio. And this is another opportunity for that to happen.
I agree. And look, the reality is, versus the perception is that it's too hard, banks are making it too hard, it's almost impossible to get finance these days. And the reality is that it's actually not.
It's not.
It's not at all. I mean, we're getting loans done, and we're getting very good LVRs. And I mean, we just had a client this week that was on an 85% LVR.
Yeah. And not someone that most of the banks would like to lend to, given
exactly.
his age.
Yeah, given his age. Yeah.
In fact, I'm seeing better interest rates from clients and out of mortgage brokers than what I was seeing 6 months ago.
Yep. So, you know, I think that this perception that, you know, the Royal Commission's ruined it and you can't get finance and blah, 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 you know, it's just not true.
No.
Yep.
But, you know, the media have done their job in spooking a lot of people. And in fact, it's almost like I come in the morning and I turn on, you know, Fox News, or I turn on, CNBC, and they're talking about the Australian economy. It's almost like these commentators are getting excited that we're finally going to have our first recession in 26 years or 28 years or whatever it is.
I thought only Australia had the tall poppy syndrome.
Yeah. It's like, you know, it's like we feel like we've missed out on, you know, a couple of recessions, and finally we're going to get our recession that we really want.
I need something different to talk about.
Last bit of data, and look, Louis, you've got a bit of a knack when I'm talking about property here to always have something that relates to the what my next point
what's
is.
What's it going to be?
Well, you talked about the middle market.
Oh.
Okay, and how you sort of saw that. So the last bit of data I thought was interesting here is the transaction volumes in the different price points.
Okay.
And interestingly, I mean, the headline on this article is that million-dollar sales reign supreme despite the downturn. Basically, the underlying point in the article is that there's more million-dollar sales happening now than ever before, and that's continuing to grow.
Right.
Wow. So that's a sign of strength in the market.
Interesting.
Okay. So after, so the analysts that put this article together have cast their eye over 25 years worth of data, and across the combined capital cities, sales below $200,000 accounted for just 1.8% of all sales, which you'd expect. I mean, it's very hard to find a good or a property worth buying at that price. I mean, yeah, if you can find one that makes
that's
sense,
right.
I'll look at it.
And if you can find it in Melbourne.
People could probably buy cash for that. While sales
I'll withdraw some money from the ATM.
While sales of million-dollar properties accounted for 19.5% of all sales.
Okay.
Right.
And what about the middle ground?
Okay, so we'll get to that too. So the dominant price point over 2018 for sales was between, as Louis alluded, in that middle ground there, the $400,000 to $600,000 range, accounting for 28.3%.
Right.
Okay. But there's a chart here in this article that shows that over time, and I guess the earliest part of the chart is December 93, and the latest is December 2018, shows that the $1 million plus price point has more transaction volumes than the $800,000 to $1 million range, and significantly more than the below $300,000 range.
Right.
Okay. So price points are moving up. So I guess a good long-term, you know, a point for why property does grow in value over the long term.
Yeah. Brett, I'm going to give you some homework for something I've just thought of.
I don't know if I like this.
In the share market,
there's
something called the Smart Money Index, which is looking the assumption that people whose job it is to invest in the share markets do more of their trading at a certain time of day than your typical retail buyer. Your typical retail buyer who probably doesn't know as much what they're doing, they'll buy on the market opening. Is that correct, Joel?
Correct.
And your Smart Money Index is looking at, well, who's doing their trading in the last hour of the day?
That's right.
Because it's only the people watching the market who are trading in that last hour. Is there something like that in the property market? Is there some price point or timing feature
to say,
well, the smart money is buying this type of property and this type of property is moving in this direction?
Right. Let me just say, challenge accepted. Tune in next week and I'll have an answer.
I reckon
if you put an index of Jewish buying activity or selling activity.
Okay. I preempted it. I think next week, though.
I think you would have a smart money index in real estate.
Yeah. All right.
I'll see if there is data we can actually obtain for that rather than just opinion. But I tend to align with Joel's thinking. We've got some networks that inform us of that.
No, let's just do some racial profiling and assume that across the market. Let's do that. Much better. All right, listeners, we'll take a break now and we'll be back with some more.
Are you concerned about your finances? Maybe you're not sure if you'll have enough money to retire on. Or maybe you've received a redundancy, inheritance, or even a significant promotion, or perhaps a life-changing medical diagnosis. Regardless of your concern or financial position, United Global Capital's advisors are experts in the areas of strategic financial planning, taxation, superannuation and self-managed superannuation funds, risk management, estate planning, and investments. Don't let fate dictate your financial future. Take control today and contact United Global Capital for a no-cost, no-obligation financial strategy consultation. Simply call 03 8657 7640 or email info@ugc.net.au and book your appointment today.
And welcome back.
Well, we've had our say. Must be your turn, Louis.
Time for my favourite part of the podcast. My turn.
Yes.
So I've been talking about how to get your finances in order after the new year, if you promise to get your finances in order this year. I've been talking about different things each week. I've talked about tracking your finances from the last 12 months to work out if you're actually ahead at the end of last year or behind at the end of last year. I've talked about restructuring your debts. I've talked about renegotiating your income with your work. I've talked about automating your savings. And I've talked about negotiating your expenses and looking at your regular bills and seeing if you can get better deals. So I've only got a couple of topics left and they're related. if you have followed these steps, then your cash flow should now be in a much better position.
Can I just ask, Louis, we did have the steps numbered in the previous episodes, I believe.
We did, and we've covered five of them.
Five, so we're on step six?
This is now step six.
Okay.
And step six and step seven are related.
Okay. Mm-hmm. We're covering both today?
We'll touch on both, but we'll focus on one. And what I mean to focus on is, well, the logical next step, I should say, is sorting out your superannuation. Mm. So if you've got one super fund, then that's good, but you need to look at what it's invested in and what it's doing. If you've got multiple super funds, you need to do the same thing, but also look at whether you can consolidate or not. But I'm actually going to have that as step seven, because before you make any changes to superannuation, you need to know what your insurance situation is. And I'm talking about life insurance and disability insurance here. So step six is to review your insurances, because you can't consolidate your superannuation until you've reviewed your insurances and you know what you need there.
Okay. Absolutely.
So step six, reviewing your insurances, involves thinking about the what-if situations. You can do all the great planning with your finances that you like, but if something happens to your health or your ability to earn an income, so I'm not talking about getting the sack, because if you get the sack, your health is still good and you can find another job. But I'm talking about what if there's an accident or an illness that means you can't look for work? Or what if there's a family member that passes away and your family is reliant on that person being around to either support the household or provide an income? Superannuation funds will often provide insurances for these, with or without you knowing about it. And it's a major hurdle to some of the reforms that that the government is trying to bring in, because on the one hand, the Productivity Commission and lots of politicians are saying everyone is better off having one super fund to avoid the duplication of fees. But on the other hand, these multiple super accounts might be providing valuable insurance cover for people. Mm-hmm. So you can't just automatically consolidate your super accounts, because you might be taking insurance away from someone who really needs it.
The interesting thing I find about this topic, Louis, as well, is that a lot of people, I would assume, think that, well, if I want protection for my income or, you know, death, you know, life insurance for my family, I have to pay for that and I need to go and take out a policy, whereas it's perfectly legal and it's widely used that it's actually paid for by their super fund, so they're not out of pocket personally out of their day-to-day.
That's exactly right.
Income.
Yeah.
Okay.
And the thing is, the people who most need insurance tend to be people with young families, and these are the people whose budgets are under the most strain. So often they don't have the budget to actually pay for the insurance, but when you've got a newborn baby, you really need insurance, because if something happens to your family at that point, then you're very exposed to leave a single parent left behind with a newborn baby to raise. So that's where we often look to draw money from super, and you do need to have plans to better your finances in future, but often at that stage of people's financial life cycle, they are going negative in making sure they have appropriate insurance through that period of time. So what do we use as a guide for people to have an appropriate amount of insurance? Here's what you can't say. You can't say, my super fund has insurance, so I'm okay.
There's no rule of thumb.
There's no rule of thumb, but it's definitely not a checkbox, because one super fund might have an automatic $100,000 of life insurance. Another super fund might have an automatic $300,000 of life insurance. If you just say, my super fund's got it, therefore I'm okay, well, how much does it actually have?
What's
for
appropriate?
You? What's appropriate? And what's the average mortgage size?
Ooh.
For a young family?
Yeah.
It's not $100,000.
No, significantly more.
It's not $300,000.
Nope.
The average mortgage size is substantially larger than the average default amount of insurance through a super fund.
Absolutely.
And the reason that's important?
The reason that's important,
yep.
Well, think of the family who's left behind.
Yeah.
So that's what the thinking has to come down to. So in a situation, what if a family member dies? How much funding is needed for the person left behind? So let's have a look through that situation. And what if a person doesn't die, but what if they are injured or have an accident and they can't work? And what if that is permanent? Mm-hmm. What is the funding the family needs in order to continue their life? And in any of these situations for insurance, you need to look at three questions. How is my family going to handle the expenses to do with the event? How is my family going to handle our debts? Mm-hmm. And how is my family going to have an ongoing income? So if we look at a person passing away, what are the expenses to do with dying? Well, there's expenses like legal fees, the actual cost of a funeral, probably some medical bills or hospital bills to be paid, yep, at the end. We tend to leave around $30,000 for that. Mm-hmm. So it's not a huge amount, but it does need to be included. Mm-hmm. And then, do you want to leave your family without a home loan?
Yes.
Well, the answer is probably yes. So let's add that to the amount of insurance that you need. Okay, so now you've left your family with no home loan and no expenses, but what is your family going to do for an ongoing income? Because if you're not around, mm-hmm, then is your partner going to work full-time and earn an income, or part-time, or not work at all, yeah, so they either can care for one, mm-hmm, or two or three children?
Absolutely, yep.
So what's the income they need? Yes, they're debt-free, but they still need an ongoing income. So how much insurance are you going to have to provide how much income for what period of time?
Yeah.
And that's how you put those three elements together and you come up with the final figure.
Yeah.
What we generally find is that a young family will come to a life insurance figure of more than $1 million.
Wow. That's just a lot.
It is a lot. It sounds like a big number, but that's the value of a person.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I mean, if
that sounds cheap when you put it on a person. Yeah.
Just financially speaking, if you've got a person in their 30s or 40s and they've got 20 to 30 years of their career left ahead of them, well, they're going to be earning $2 or $3 million.
Yeah.
Over that period of time.
Hence the saying, worth more dead than alive.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah. So if you
don't give them ideas.
So if you only have $1 million of insurance, let's imagine what that gets you. If you've only got insurance on your life of $1 million, let's say your home loan is $500,000. And then you subtract a little bit for expenses, you've only got roughly $500,000 or less for an ongoing income for your family. And if your family needs $40,000 or $50,000 per year just to pay its costs, well, then you've only got around 10 years worth of income.
Yeah. Mm.
And that's why we find it's very common to have people needing more than $1.5 million of insurance to pay off their debts and leave an ongoing income.
Yep.
So the default insurance that you have in a super fund, if it's $100,000 or $300,000 or even $500,000,
not going to cut it.
It's still not going to cut it.
No.
So you need to have those considerations. You need to do the same for total and permanent disability insurance, and critically, you need to have income protection insurance with a long benefit period, up to the age of 65. Because if you can't work, you need income protection insurance, mm-hmm, to keep paying you monthly for as long as you can't work up until retirement. Mm-hmm. So you need to have those things sorted out. If there's one super fund that can provide all of those things, great. If you don't have those things in place at the moment, then look for where you can get those insurances, either through a super fund or through a retail insurance provider, which generally provides better quality contracts. Mm-hmm. And generally provides more control to you, to control your insurances, rather than being subject to another super fund's rules, and get that insurance sorted out.
Yeah.
Even if you take a retail insurance policy, you can still have it paid from your super fund, even if it's not with your superannuation provider.
That's great to know.
Yeah. So you need to look at that insurance position only once you know your insurance strategy. Are you then in a position to figure out, well, these are the super funds I need because they have insurance, and these are the super funds that I can actually get rid of if they don't have the right attributes that I'll talk about next week.
Okay.
Yeah, fantastic.
Great stuff.
Absolutely. Just to hammer that point home, sound financial planning is not just about wealth creation. It's also about wealth protection and protecting your family. And, you know, you need to be looking at all of these aspects when putting together a financial plan. And I couldn't have said it any better. Louis?
Yep,
thank you. It's like any game. You've got to have a sound balance of attack and defense.
Absolutely.
That's right. And we can do all these amazing things to build your wealth. But if you don't have a risk management plan, well, then all of that building can come crashing down very quickly. Yep. Yeah. My own personal experience is that for every 100 clients that I manage, there's one a year that will phone me and say, something's happened, we've lost our income.
Yep.
Wow.
It's either an injury, or I've got cancer and I'm going in for an operation.
Absolutely.
Or I've got a heart condition and I can't work for a couple of months, or I find it's about 1 in 100 per year.
Yep, I would agree with that, absolutely.
Yep. So the thing for us as financial planners is when we have 100 clients, we don't know which client is going to be the one. So we need to make sure that everyone has appropriate insurance.
Yep.
And if you're my client for 10 years, well, then your chance is actually 1 in 10. And if you're my client for 20 years, yeah, your chance is 1 in 5. And if you're just an ordinary person in Australia, your chance of having cancer is 1 in 2 for males and 1 in 3 for females.
Ouch.
Mm-hmm.
It's just the statistics.
Yep.
Yeah, it is.
Yep. And you can't do anything to change it. Cancer does not discriminate.
No.
You can be perfectly healthy, and these things can happen.
Agreed.
Fantastic, Louis. Really well put. And
thank you. All right. Well, that's my topic for the day, sorting out your insurance. Stay tuned next week for the final installment of Superannuation. Let's raise the tone a bit now, guys. What's next?
Serious.
All right, you cannot be serious, fellas. What's been happening?
The Irish are regularly the butt of jokes, especially for Australians, but with good reason on this one. And it's not necessarily a joke, it's a real life event.
Oh, okay.
One particular lady called the police to say, I've been scammed. And of course the police say, what, are you out of any money? And she says, yeah, I paid over £200 and I got brown sugar instead. The policeman says, instead of what? She said, cocaine.
You cannot be serious!
Oh my goodness.
Not that I know much about cocaine, but I'm pretty sure it comes as brown, brown anyway.
Yeah, that's right.
Wow. The good quality stuff.
Oh, you know all about it.
I don't know. I don't know much about it. I've seen a lot of movies on Hollywood.
Oh, of course.
The incident was published by the Craigavon Police Station on social media and had some interesting comments such as... that looks like a sweet scam and nothing beats a sugar high.
Oh, very good. Well, everyone knows the human body has a few quirks to it. It can be quite strange. There was a man who went to his doctor because he had a blocked nose that had been blocked for 2 years.
Cool, a long time.
So what's going on with this nose? They did investigations, they did x-rays, and his body was growing an extra tooth.
Oh!
In his nasal cavity.
Oh. You cannot be serious!
Very strange.
Oh, that's bizarre.
So how's that for strange bodies?
I thought it might have been linked to cocaine, but...
Yeah. Well, maybe that's why he saw his doctor. It's like, Doc, I just can't do this anymore.
Goodness.
Thanks for joining us for another week, listeners. We'll be back next week. Thank you, Brett.
Thank you, Louis, and thank you to all the women.
Thank you, Joel.
Thanks, mate.
Thanks all the women out there. Enjoy your International Women's Day.
You've been listening to this week's episode of The Investor Exchange. To access this episode's show notes, go to theinvestorexchange.com.au and follow us on Facebook at The Investor Exchange for updates on our latest episodes. This show is for entertainment and educational purposes only. Before making any investment decision, contact United Global Capital by emailing ugc.net.au for a personalized, no-cost, no-obligation financial strategy consultation. Or alternatively, email us at info@ugc.net.au.